So this evening, our goal is to catch ourselves up all the way to where we left off in Genesis chapter 19. And so we're going to start at chapter 12, where we left off last week in our review, and pick up with the story of Abraham. Now, once again, I just want to review just briefly the twofold division of the book that we're picking up tonight. You remember that we talked about chapters 1 through 11 as being the global purpose, starting with creation, the fall, and the flood, and the Tower of Babel, and all these world events that show that God's plan is for the whole world. And we saw how God created the earth good, but yet because of sin, the world fell under the curse and under death, and death spread to the whole world, and we saw the consequences of that. And yet in the midst of it, even all the way back in Genesis chapter 3, that we saw that God still had a plan, and God has a plan to restore blessing to the world. God has a plan to, if you will, bring creation back to its Edenic state, back to the Garden of Eden, back to the good that he intended for mankind. And ultimately, as we saw in Genesis chapter 3, that's going to be through the seed of the woman. And so one of the major themes that we're going to trace throughout the book of Genesis and continue to see is this idea of the seed and the promise of this seed that's going to come. And in one sense, with every new son that's born, with every new child, there's almost this expectancy. Could this be the one? Could this be the serpent crusher who's going to come and destroy evil? And there's always that expectancy and that hope that that could occur. And so we need to keep that in mind, because so much of the narratives starting in chapter 12 and following are about children. They're about the seed. They're about the sons. And remember, it's not just, oh, keeping on the family name. You know, it's just like, oh, we just hope that the Grauman line doesn't get cut off. No, we're talking about the salvation of the world, right? That's God's plan to save the world, is through this seed of the woman. And through this child of promise, if you will. And so we need to keep that in mind, because it's so easy for us to be like, oh, another genealogy, and you know, what's significance of this? Well, it's tracing the seed, it's tracing the line, and ultimately, as we know, it's going to trace itself all the way to our Lord Jesus Christ, and obviously our hope is ultimately found in him. And so just once again, as we start in Genesis, it gives us such a perspective to stand at the beginning of time and look through the corridor of time and all of God's plan and his purpose for this earth. And as we said, it starts off so global, and we understand that God does have a plan for this world, for this earth, for all of humanity. As we come to chapter 12, we change focus. Right now, what are some of the ways that we could, we've talked about this before, so I'll put it in the form of a question. What are some of the differences between chapters 1 through 11 and 12 through 50?
More detail.
Say that more detail. More detail? Yeah, absolutely. Depending on, you know, what you mean by that. Detailed in the sense of, I would probably frame it in the sense that they're more individualistic, I guess. You know, we're zooming in, not on the whole global perspective, but we're going to look at individuals now. So if that's what you meant, which I presume it is, you know, it is much more detailed. We're going to deal with, you know, individual stories of what happened to this man and this man. And it's, in a sense, it's kind of interesting because, you know, you start off and everything is so big and grandiose, the Tower of Babel, and you start getting in and it's just like one man, one family. And it's almost like, I don't know how to say it, but it's almost like, oh, these are just nice stories now. We've kind of left the... But what's been interesting for me just to think about is how God's plan comes in and starts with the man. Right? God's plan is to use an individual. God's plan centers on obedient individuals who do his will. And so as we come into Abraham here and we start this story in chapters 12 and following, I think that's such a huge lesson for us that, you know, when God has a plan to save the world, it involves just one obedient individual. And so much the message of, I think, this section is that God uses individuals. God uses those who trust in him and obey him. And he does magnificent things through one single person. One single person who's obedient to him who's faithful to him, who trusts him no matter what. Even one individual who fails at times. And we see, so as we come into these stories of Abraham, we're going to see the triumphs and the failures of faith. Right? We're going to see the man of faith who walked with God, who was obedient to God. And we see his life, the good and the bad and the ugly. Right? All of the above. And the message to us is, on the one hand, we see that God's plan will not fail. And that is a major theme that runs throughout this book, that, you know, even when it looks like all is lost, God's plan won't fail. But yet you have to kind of hold that in tension with the fact that, yes, God's plan won't fail, but on the other hand, God works through individuals who are obedient. And you can't ask the question, you can't have kind of an apathetic attitude that's like, well, God's going to accomplish his plan no matter what, so I could just kick back and who cares what happens. We see throughout this story that the reason why God's plan was through this individual is because he was obedient, because he did trust God. And so those two things are kind of held in tension, and you kind of wrestle with it. You're like, on the one hand, you see Abraham's sin, and it's like the plan almost comes to the brink of destruction, you know, as Sarah, his wife, almost goes in with, you know, these other men, and it's like the seed is almost corrupted. But on the other hand, you see that God is sovereign. And so you see that tension between the fact that Abraham must be obedient, he must walk in faith, and also on the other hand, doesn't matter what happens, God is going to accomplish his plan. And I think that's important for us as well, right? We know that God is going to work out his plan in and through us, but yet at the same time, he wants us to be obedient. And so as we walk through these chapters, they're very much lessons of, and it's like what I said last week, trusting and obeying. Right? We see Abraham, we see the lessons he learned, we see how God worked through him. And yet we see on the bigger scale how God is working out his plan to save the world through one lowly man. And so it's beautiful as we walk through the book of Genesis and we see how God elected and chose this man, Abraham, and ultimately he chose the nation of Israel. You know, as we get all the way to Deuteronomy, it says, you know, I didn't choose you because you were the greatest of all nations. And this, I'm sure the same could be said of Abraham. I didn't choose you because you were the greatest man on the earth. You know, I chose you to show my own power and glory and to use you as part of my plan. And so that of course, is so true for us, just in God's choosing of us. As the New Testament says, not many wise, not many, etc., etc., right? But he chose us nonetheless to be a part of his plan. He calls us to faithful obedience. All right, so let's dive into the text then. And the more I study just these stories, the more excited I get just about the great lessons that there are for us. And so as we said, as we go from a global focus to a focus just on one man and just on the focus of Israel, we see that this watershed event in all of Scripture is this Abrahamic covenant. And once again, as we said, this is God's plan to save the world. So turn to chapter 12 of Genesis, and the first three verses here are, I would say, the key verses in all of Genesis, and probably in many senses the whole Pentateuch and all of Scripture. Just such amazing verses. And so verse 12:1 says, "Now Yahweh said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great in order that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." This awesome, awesome promise. You know, you notice in there, you just read through it, the whole earth will be blessed through this one man. We're going to see that theme running throughout these chapters, how Abraham really becomes the priest for the whole world. And we'll see that blessing only comes through association with Abraham. And ultimately, you know, later on, through the nation of Israel. Just once again, kind of keep this in perspective. This was written to the nation of Israel as their constitution, as they're going into the land to conquer it and to be, you know, God's nation. And remember, the whole plan was for the nation of Israel to be a light, for the nation of Israel to be the light to the nations and to the Gentiles, that all the world would see how great God is through the nation of Israel, and that all the world would be blessed through them. And so you see that even here, starting with Abraham, we see that other people are blessed in association with Abraham. If you want to know God, you go to Abraham. You want to know God, the lesson is you go to Israel. And you see that fleshed out throughout the whole Old Testament. That was the plan, right? That God would make his nation great and exalt them as they're obedient to him. And he gave them his law so that they would be righteous and obedient. And the whole world would look at them and see how great is God. And they'd go to them to be a part of God's plan. But ultimately, we know that that failed through the nation of Israel and was fulfilled through Christ. And ultimately will be fulfilled when Christ comes as king over all the earth. But I just want to point that out again. It's through Abraham that the world will be blessed. Just that last statement in verse 3. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And I love also this statement in verse 2. I will make you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great. All these great promises. Now, I don't know which translation you have, but I would agree with the way the ESV translates this. I think NASB does it a little bit different. I would disagree, but there's a little subtlety in the grammar here. It says, I will make your name great in order that, or so that, you will be a blessing. And the idea is, and this fits so well with what's taught in Deuteronomy, that God is going to bless Abraham and make him great in order that he would bless others. Right? And I could go to Deuteronomy. We don't have time to do that this evening. We kind of did it way back at the beginning when we surveyed the whole Pentateuch. But that's exactly what God said of Israel. I'm going to make you great so that my blessing will flow forth from you to others. And that's exactly what we see here of Abraham. And so you say, what's God's plan to restore blessing to the world? This is it. It's through this seed of the woman who's, we've traced the genealogy here. We're tracing it all the way down to Abraham. This is the man that God has chosen to be his plan to save the world, and ultimately through the nation of Israel. And so we start off with these great, great promises. And also, as we see in verse 4, so Abram went as the Lord, as Yahweh had told him. Just a great statement right there. Simple obedience. You even love how it starts off, right? Go from your father's country and your kindred and your father's house. Where is he going? He doesn't even know, right? It's just, I'll show you. Just start heading that way, you know, and I'll show you when you get there. It really points out to his faith. And even just the terminology, you know, leave all your friends and your family is basically how you could translate verse 1, right? You know, leave everything. Go where I'm going to tell you later where you're going. Just head out. And so Abraham went. And just once again, he's the man of faith because of his simple trust in God. And we see how God is going to use him in such powerful ways because he obeyed, because he trusted God, because he walked with God. And so as we start off in verse 12, he heads out. And then takes Lot in verse 5 and all their possessions, and they pass through the land. And verse 7, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to Yahweh who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, Bethel, in verse 8. And there he built an altar to Yahweh and called upon the name of Yahweh. Just want to point out there that you see just his also his devotion to the Lord, his devotion to Yahweh, that he's building this altar. And it's interesting as you kind of trace through this book, you know, at kind of the high points of Abraham's life, it points out that he built an altar often, you know, just once again, just he's trusting the Lord. When it talks about how he lies about his wife and that kind of stuff, there's no altars there. You know, it's when he's walking with the Lord, he's trusting in him, he's being obedient, he's being blessed, he has that relationship. And a life of faith, I think it points out, is really a life of worship. You know, where you're in close relationship with the Lord, you're worshiping him with your life. And you can see that when Abraham here is being obedient, stepping out in faith, leaving his land, leaving everything, and going to be obedient to God. Now, as we go from here, that I could just pause there, I guess, and I've surveyed kind of some of this section. Let's just pause for questions. Is everyone tracking with that so far? So what we're going to do now is just kind of, once again, we've done it in the past, but we're going to just walk through these different stories, kind of chapter by chapter or section by section, depending on how the stories divide up, and just try to, you know, we're not going to read through all of chapters 12 through 19. That'd be kind of a big chunk to read. But just want to, I'll probably just summarize each story and try to remind ourselves the kind of those main lessons of each of these stories as we continue to watch the life of Abraham. Okay, so any other comments or observations or questions up to this point? All right. Okay, so in verses 10 through 20, I trust you remember the story. It's the story where it starts off with a famine in the land. And so Abram, verse 10, goes down to Egypt. And you know what happens. He's afraid. And what is he afraid of? Who remembers? What's that? I heard it, I think. I can't hear you.
Pharaoh.
Yeah, Pharaoh. Right? He's afraid of Pharaoh. He's afraid that Pharaoh is going to kill him and take his wife because his wife is beautiful, which is a shocking thought. I can't remember how old she is now, but 70-something.
75, so she must be 65.
Yeah, anyway, she's older. So anyway, that's a shocking thought even in and of itself. But Abraham is terrified that he's going to get killed for the sake of his wife. And so he tells his wife to lie, verse 13, and when he comes in, the Egyptians saw that she was beautiful, and they tell Pharaoh how beautiful she is. And so Pharaoh basically takes her and like starts blessing Abraham. He's like, you know, this is great, you know, and they build this relationship. But all of a sudden, verse 17, God starts afflicting Pharaoh because of Abram. And so Pharaoh calls to Abram. He's like, why did you do this? And why did you say this about your wife, and sent him away with all that he had? Now the lesson here, who remembers? What can we see here about lessons about Abraham and his life of faith? Should be some pretty surface ones, I guess.
Tell the truth and trust God that He'll take care of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell the truth and trust God. I mean, ultimately, the problem was that Abram didn't trust God in this instance. He feared Pharaoh more than he feared God. He didn't trust that, you know, God was going to protect him and God was going to keep his promises. And so he had a lapse of faith. And even that in and of itself is, I trust, somewhat of an encouragement to us, because as much as Abraham was the man of faith and just kind of this stalwart and this example and even revered because of all his great acts of faith, we see his pitfalls as well. We see that he's human. We see that God still used him, and God still loved him, and God still blessed him, and still worked incredibly through him. And so the first lesson here is obviously the need to trust God. And this is where, once again, you hold these kind of things in tension. You can kind of read this story, and by Abraham's sin, it's almost like, remember the importance here is, what are we looking for? We're looking for the seed. We're looking for this descendant. We're looking for this serpent crusher. And so when Sarah gets taken by Pharaoh, it's not just, oh, that's too bad, he might lose his wife. I mean, as bad as that would be or whatever. I mean, it's a lot bigger than this, right? Keep it in mind, in perspective of God's plan for the world. You know, here is the promised couple, and there's the potential there that by his sin, he could foil God's plan. Now, once again, we know that God's still in control, and we see that so clearly here. God's not going to let his plan go unfulfilled. But we see that in one sense, and once again, there's a tension, but Abraham jeopardized, in a sense, or put God's plan at risk by his disobedience and his lack of faith and trust. And you see, just once again, you just kind of have to hold those in tension. You can't say, well, I could go sin, do whatever, and God's just going to accomplish his plan anyway. No, this. I think part of the point of this is for you to kind of feel the tension, like, oh man, the plan is almost on the brink of falling apart here because Abraham didn't trust God. And I would say that I think that that's part of the lesson here. Both positively, we have the positive examples where we see when Abraham trusts God, how God blesses him and uses him as part of his plan in a powerful way. But on the flip side, when we see when he doesn't trust God, how, in one sense, he puts God's plan at risk. And so you kind of have to hold those things in tension. So that's what I would see as the lesson from here. Just the need, once again, to trust God. The fact that God is going to work out his plan. He promised the land to Abraham. You saw, you know, in the first three verses, all these promises. I'm going to give you the land. Verse 7, I'm going to make you a blessing. And so Abraham should grab hold of those promises and say, okay, I trust. I know that God is going to do this. And therefore, he could be unwavering in his faith. All right, that's chapter 12.
Sometimes circumstances kind of get you down. I mean, he's already dealing with with the famine and all that stuff. It's probably kind of at a low point anyhow going into Egypt.
Yeah, absolutely. And so even more so when circumstances get tough, the need to trust in God and just to hold fast to his promises. Abraham had some great promises. Now, as we come to chapter 13, we have the next story in our Abraham saga. We have the story of Abraham and Lot. And just to summarize, you know the basic gist is, as Abraham goes out of Egypt, he had tons of wealth. He had livestock, he had resources. And so as they get to the land of Canaan, they return there after the famine. He and Lot are kind of, you know, have all their flocks and herds together. They've all gone together. And there kind of gets to be a dispute between Abraham and Lot's herdsmen because there's not enough land for all the animals and everything. So they get to have this dispute. And you see in verse 8, we'll pick up there. Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, I will go to the right. You take the right, I will go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of Yahweh, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before Yahweh destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against Yahweh. Now this is interesting right here. What do we see right off the bat? What does Abraham do? Just in that section, summarize it in your own words. Good. He gave the choice to Lot, you know, which way are you going to go? Now, in and of itself, I would say, as I've read this context in this story, I would see that as being an act of faith. He's really giving Lot the better choice. He's being selfless, I guess, if you could put it that way, in his act. And it's interesting because God had promised Abram already the land. And yet, in one sense, there's a tension here that there's a risk that Lot might take the land that was promised to Abram. But Abram gives Lot the choice. And notice what Lot says. He saw the land with his eyes. You know, he lifted up his eyes, and we've seen that before, haven't we? Right? That the fruit was good to the eyes. Lot is choosing, I think, based on what he sees, right? And just like Eve with the fruit, and just like, you know, earlier in Genesis, the problem was he was basing his decision based on what he could see and based on his own desires and his own preferences, right? Rather than, you know, seeking to do what God would want and seeking to, you know, obey God more than anything else. And so we see Abraham's faith in giving Lot the better choice. And we see Lot's selfishness and really unwise decision. We're going to see that from this point on, Lot is just going to go down, 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 downhill. I mean, as you see here, twice it says that, you know, mentions Sodom. Verse 13 kind of puts in this almost parenthetical statement about how wicked the men of Sodom were. And, you know, Lot's going towards Sodom. And as we keep tracing this story in the chapters to come, Lot's going to go from, like, living kind of close to Sodom, to pitching his tent close, to being in Sodom, to sitting in the gate of Sodom. You know, he's just getting more and more kind of entrenched. It's kind of this downward spiral as he associates with these wicked men. And so we see Abram's act of faith, his generosity in giving Lot the better choice. And we're going to see Lot's foolish choice and just the repercussions of that choice. And so it's just interesting, as we said, that, you know, Abram even gave Lot the choice, which he knew. How do I say that? He gave Lot the choice even though he knew that God was going to give him and fulfill the promise to the land. He didn't know how. You know, that there's part of him that can maybe say, well, I need to choose the land because I need to make sure that I fulfill the promise. But once again, if you trust God, you walk in obedience to him and trust in him, and you wait for him to work out the details. Right? All that's called for us to do is to trust in God and to obey him. And so certainly just being selfless in this act of giving Lot the choice was an act of just obedience and faith. And you leave the details up to God. God's going to work it out. He promised. You don't have to worry about, and we're going to see once later in the book, right? Abraham's going to try to take the promise in his own hands with going in with Hagar, right? But that's not what God calls. God says, I promise this. You just need to hold fast to that promise and know that I will fulfill it. Okay, did you have a question, Will, or?
Yeah. So at this time, Abram just knows that he's getting the Canaanite land.
Right.
And is that include the Jordan land? Or?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it does. I'd have to go look at a map to see the full extent. It doesn't really get too explicit at this point. Just the only thing that we have thus far is 12:7. It says, to your offspring I will give this land. And but that, you know, notice where he's at. He's at Shechem and the Oaks of Moreh. That's not so much in the Jordan Valley itself. Later we see that the promise, like, I don't know if you want to say it's broadened, but it certainly gets more defined and I think would include even the Jordan Valley. Does that make sense? So it's not real, it doesn't start off real defined. It's just like, I will give you this land. And it doesn't really say how far that goes. Although, you know, at the time, I think Abraham's in the hill country. So if I had a map of Israel, just think of, all right, if my right arm is the Jordan River, and over here is the Mediterranean, okay, I guess it'd be the other way around for most of you. But anyway, the hill country kind of comes in this middle territory here, and that's where Shechem is, and he's kind of, most of Abraham's sojournings are in the hill country, the middle area there, whereas the Jordan Valley, like where the Dead Sea is, that's where Lot chose, that was the well-watered area. Now ultimately, I think the promise extends to there, but I don't know if at this point it's there yet. So either, I guess I could put it this way, either way, Abram giving the choice to Lot is, you know, kind of leaving the fulfillment up to God. He doesn't know what Lot could choose. He's kind of, you know, either way you look at it, it's like, well, I'm the man with the promise. I should be able to choose whatever's the best land, whatever's the this or the that, you know. But he really just kind of leaves that up to God and acts selflessly. And ultimately we see that Lot acts selfishly and unwisely as he associates with the wicked men of Sodom.
I don't know, it kind of seems like if you were like kind of naive about the ultimate promise, you would have thought that the land that God chose is not the land we're given. Because you might not think, oh, I'm going to have enough kids for all of the nation, I'm just going to have a tribe like everybody else. I don't need all that.
Well, part of it, though, we have to remember is just the context in which it's written. It's written to the Israelites as they're about to cross the Jordan Valley and go in and conquer the land that is, you know, the hill country, I guess you could say. They had already, you know, when this was written, they had already conquered the Trans-Jordan, right? You have the 2.5 tribes that already conquered that. So they're about to go in and take the hill country. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but they already knew what God wanted them to conquer. They already knew that what the quote-unquote land that had been given to them was. It's this whole area of the Canaanites. In the story here, it's not really defined, but as the recipients would have come in, they knew, okay, we're going to come in and this is our land. And they basically knew the borders of it by that time. Does that make sense? So the author doesn't necessarily need to define it at the early point in the story, because he knows as the story goes along, it's going to define it more and more. And that's one of the, what's one of the lessons of this is that as the Israelites were sitting on the border of the land of promise, they saw that this land was their ancestors hundreds of years before. And so as they go in to conquer the Canaanites, that's a major lesson here, is this is our land. God gave it to us. He promised it to us, right? It's ours by right of divine right, because God had given it to them. And so once again, we see Abram's just trust and faith in God's promise. He gave Lot the better choice. And notice as a result what happens in verse 14. Then Yahweh said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, "Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land that you see I will give to you and to your offspring forever." And just the way that the story flows there, and where it starts off by saying after Lot separated, it seems to reaffirm that it's because Abram did the selfless thing. And he didn't take the best land for himself, trying to think, let me try to get the best land, let me try to make sure that I get what's mine, what I deserve. But he left that to God, and so God gives him, reaffirms this promise to him, and even extends it as he looks around, and everything that he could see, God says, I'm going to give to you. And so I think even there, Will, you know, it somewhat expands it, because, you know, it's everything that he could see at that point. So I'm sure you could see quite a long ways from there. And yeah, did you have...
Yeah, I forget the correct term for it, but doesn't that also illustrate the increasing revelation of God concerning the promise?
Yeah, progressive revelation, yeah.
Do you think that kind of is in the story, like Abraham only knew a little bit to start off, but God progressively revealed more and more the promise?
Yeah, absolutely. As it starts off, you know, you have the initial promise in 12:1-3. You know, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to bless the earth through you. But as we keep going through here, you have covenant reaffirmations, and God keeps reaffirming the covenant to him. Ultimately, we're going to get to chapters 15 and 17, if I keep moving tonight. You know, and God reaffirms, he gives him the covenant of circumcision, he reveals more and more, and then even after the Pentateuch, you know, you get the Davidic covenant, which kind of basically is an expansion on this, that a king is going to come. And you, as you said, the initial promise, it just becomes clarified and expanded in its full extent.
Right.
So it just keeps getting clarified.
It's just kind of, yeah, I was just trying to get that clear, because some people might say that it's only there because of writer purpose. You know, the writer wants to make this story flow, and so puts this at one point and then tells us more about it later.
Right.
But it's really like the way God acted with Abraham, it seems to be, and told him a little bit to start off with, but then more and more as he got down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you see, even just to keep on that same point, you look at verse 16, "I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth." Right? So if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also could be counted. Now that's the first, that's an expansion.
Yeah.
Right? Because you started off, it's just, I'm going to make you great. But here it's like, you know, let's define that even more so. Your offspring are going to be this numerous. Right? So it's an expansion on what we see in 12:1-3. And so as a result, I'll put it this way, as a result of his obedience and trust in God that we see in verses 8-13, God responds by further blessing and further revealing to him the full extent of this promise. And so once again, the message is, if as we're obedient to God, God uses us to accomplish his plan and purpose. And so once again, just the need, yeah, we tend to think we need to take things into our own hands. And I'm not saying we should be like passive and inactive, but there is just a sense of trusting God and obeying him and not trying to take things into our own hands in a wrong way that seem, you know, would be, you know, trying to seize things that aren't for us to do. And you see that message run throughout here. And so it just keeps on, and once again, as verse 18, there he built an altar to Yahweh. Once again, that expression of worship that shows that his life is a life of worship. It's just he walks in obedience and trust to God. He called on the name of the Lord. Oh, sorry. Sorry. What happened there? I skipped two pages. All right, chapter
17, it says, "Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you."
Yeah, absolutely.
That's pretty cool. God has him walk out the whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, anything about chapter 13, we better keep moving or else this summary is going to become a re-preaching of all. All right, chapter 14. Chapter 14 is probably one of the most interesting chapters in this whole section. If you read verses 1 through 7, you have this, basically it's this international battle scene. And you have five kings and four kings. I'm trying to remember which is which. The five kings come in and attack the four kings, if I remember correctly. And the four kings are the kings from Abraham's land. And basically, you know, there's this massive coalition of forces that come together and go into battle. And the kings in Abraham's area basically get defeated and they run off with all this spoil. And so in the midst of all that, Lot gets captured. And so I would say that, well, anyway, so that gets us to verse 12. That's a summary of the first 12 verses, just really quick. So they also took Lot, who was dwelling in Sodom. Notice that, right? Lot went from just kind of going and living near Sodom. Now he's in Sodom. And then he gets captured as a result. Okay? And so verse 13, someone escaped and told Abram. When Abram heard, verse 14, that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and he defeated them and pursued them to Haba, north of Damascus. And then he brought back all the possessions, and he also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. And so basically, the first part of this story is, it's crazy. It's this international battle scene with all these kings, and there's a battle, and these kings run off with Lot, and Abram's like, all right, we're going to go defeat them. And so he takes like 318 of his men, which for one just shows how much God has blessed Abram. And he just steps out, and I would say steps out in faith. Once again, he's not doing this selfishly. I mean, if you could even think from a selfish standpoint, he might even say, well, forget Lot. You know, he's the selfish one. You know, Lot, as we continue to walk through this story, you know, doesn't always make the best choices. Maybe it would be easy for Abraham to say, well, I'm tired of dealing with him, whatever. But once again, he steps out in faith, not for his own sake, but for the sake of his relative. I think we have to understand a little bit too, just that when it says he's his brother, he's his relative, it just points out the obligation, just kind of like the community obligation he would have to his kinsmen. And so, once again, it's just Abraham being faithful to that, stepping out in faith, and he goes and just defeats them. And once again, it's just God's blessing on Abraham. It shows that Abraham has really become an international player on the scene, that God has blessed him so immensely in this battle. And then we have this fascinating story in verses 17 through 24, that after he returns from the king, from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. It's kind of an interesting thing that happens here. So Abraham goes, he defeats these kings, he comes back with Lot, all the possessions, actually not just Lot, but all the possessions of all his, kind of the kings that were around him that got captured. So he comes and like gets everything back that was taken. And he comes back, and the king of Sodom, right, he's one of the guys that got whooped on, is going out to meet Abram. Now, if you're not reading this carefully, there's two kings here. There's the king of Sodom and the king of Salem. So you got to keep these two kings straight. So the king of Sodom is on his way to meet Abram, and then before he gets there, the king of Salem shows up. Okay? So that's where we get to verse 18.
Do you think these guys really had that many men? Because it kind of sounds like with so many kings, they're really more like chieftains, you know, smaller groups. And there's the vassal kings that were doing the rebellion, and but maybe kind of more like chieftains with like maybe 100 men each or something.
Well, I...
If he was able to defeat them with 318.
Well, I would say probably... I mean, certainly they're not kings like Nebuchadnezzar was a king. Okay, that I would say is true. And that, you know, from a latter standpoint, they're not kings of the same kind of like, global nature. That's absolutely true. But I wouldn't say that they probably only had 100 men each, necessarily. Like, these were, I mean, they're kings over fairly decently large city-state areas. And so, I mean, I don't know how many men this would have been. But I do think it points out Abraham's faith, you know, that he probably took down a larger army and just even, by God's blessing, he was able to defeat. But also his tactics, you know, he comes and strikes at night while they're all sleeping, you know, with his 318 men. And I mean, even we see later in Scripture, you know, like Gideon with his 300 wipes out thousands upon thousands of... I'm not saying there was necessarily that many.
Yeah,
you know,
they woke up and started fighting each other.
Right. You know, but certainly I think that this does point to the fact that God gave Abram the victory, so I wouldn't minimize either, you know, the size of this army. Because I think the fact that it points out how many kings there were and that kind of the they came from far away.
Yeah.
So it's not like these were just like, you know, chiefs over one little city or something.
Mm-hmm. It was had bigger city-states.
Yeah, exactly. So... you know, somewhere in between there. We don't know, obviously, the details, but I do think it points out to Abram's faith in going to attack a force of that kind of an army. So anyway, verse 18, Melchizedek comes in, and you know this story that he was a priest of God Most High. He was a king priest of Salem, and he blessed Abram and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." So once again, you see that the victory is by the Lord, right? And once again, we see that Abram, I tried to combine Abraham and Abram there, you know, Abram is blessed of God, right? He's chosen of God. He's the man of blessing. And we keep seeing that throughout this section. So Abram gives Melchizedek a tenth of everything. And now the king of Sodom comes in verse 21. Okay, so I would say that the little story about Melchizedek, it emphasizes how blessed Abram is, and that the victory was because he is blessed of God. Once again, the story is, you want to be on God's side, you be on Abram's side, right? You want to know about God, you have to learn about him through Israel, right? God is working through this man. That's really the emphasis. And so as the Israelites got that, hopefully they would have got the message, right? God is working out his plan through us. Through us as a nation being obedient to him. God is working through Abraham. He's God's man. And so you see that. But then you kind of have this sandwich structure where it starts off with the king of Sodom coming to meet. And then in between there, Melchizedek comes. And now the king of Sodom gets there. And notice the lesson here. Verse 21. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." In other words, the king of Sodom's like, "Hey, thank you so much for going and rescuing all my guys that got captured in this battle. Give me back the people, but all the gold or whatever the goods were that were captured, you keep it." Okay? But look what Abram says once again. Abram says to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted my hand to Yahweh God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich." What an awesome statement. Why does he do that? I mean, obviously he does it, so he doesn't take any of the stuff. He's like, "No, king of Sodom, you take all your stuff." And he does it so that the king of Sodom doesn't say, you know, "I made Abram rich." But what's his heart behind there? Right, absolutely. God gets all the glory. You know, God has promised you know, I will make you a great nation, I'll bless you, on and on and on. But Abram wants it to be obvious that God's the one that's doing this. That it's, it, you know, it would be so easy to rationalize and say, yep, I'm the man of blessing. You know, this is how God wants me to get this blessing. But especially because of how wicked this king must have been, because of how wicked Sodom is, I think that's probably part of it too. You know, that he doesn't want to have any association with just this wicked king, and that this wicked king is the reason why Israel is blessed. Absolutely not. Israel is blessed because God is going to bless Israel. And this is an amazing act of faith of Abraham to stand upon that and not take even a sandal strap from the king of Sodom. So once again, we see how blessed Abraham is by God, and we see how he just acts in faith and trust in God's promise. He has such an unwavering trust in God. Okay, any questions about 14?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of talk about Melchizedek, and I was wondering where you stood. Do you think he's a Christ type or a pre-incarnate Christ? Because he's a priest and a king.
Yeah, I think I would say he's not the pre-incarnate Christ. I don't believe.
Type.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'd have to go back.
Yeah,
go to Hebrews.
Goes through that track. I was just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is pretty awesome that he's a king priest and just the first king
and
priest.
The, king of the city name means peace.
Yep.
All his Hebrew sermons are online.
Yeah, I taught through the book of Hebrews, so you want all the details about Melchizedek, you could get in there and I preached a couple sermons on him. So, but yeah, I mean, awesome figure here. The first, actually, not only the first king priest, but the first priest in all of Scripture. And so we're not going to get too much into this here, but he was obviously a man of God. And as you say, a type of Christ. All right, chapter 15. And I love this, how it starts off, after these things, just that simple little phrase, after these things, I think it shows that it's in response to what we just saw in Abraham's faith once again. The Lord came to Abraham in a vision, fear not, I am your shield, your reward shall be very great. And notice how appropriate that is, right? God, Abraham just turned down blessing. I shouldn't say blessing. He just turned down, what's the word I'm looking for? Monetary reward, riches, etc., right? You know, he turned down, if you will, protection and safety. That's what comes with the riches. But then, right after that, God comes in and says, great will be your reward, right? You just turned down a reward, and so as a result, God says, your reward will be great. And so it's cool to see how so many times you see after Abraham's act of faith, he does something that it seems almost illogical. Like, first time he kind of gives Lot the better choice of the land, and right afterward God comes in and says, here, I'm going to give you the land. Right? And here he turns down the riches, and God right away comes in and says, I will give you riches. I will give you a great reward. And so you see the blessing for faith and trusting in God and trusting in his promise. But as you see, verse 1 there, you know, God gives him this promise. But Abram said, O Lord Yahweh, what will you give me, for I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Now, I think this is not a question of doubt, especially in the context here. It's a legitimate question that says, you know, God, the only thing that really matters here is an heir and the fulfillment of the promise. So how are you going to work it out? Right? And so it's a legitimate question that God has asked, that Abraham is asking of God. You know, he doesn't have a child, and this other Damascus guy is his heir. Right? And God says, you know, through your seed I'm going to bless. And so he's like, okay, it doesn't do me any good to have your blessing if I don't have an heir and the one who's going to fulfill the promise. And so, as you see, verse 3, Abraham said, behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And notice this, verse 4, and behold, the word of Yahweh came to him, this man shall not be your heir, your own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and number the stars if you're able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And this amazing statement, and he believed Yahweh and he counted it to him as righteousness. Once again, just as you said, just a continual reaffirmation of the promise and even just an expansion on it. You know, as many as the stars of the heaven, that's going to be how great your offspring is. You know, I'm going to give you your own son, your own heir, as God comes in with this amazing promise. And just that awesome response, Abram believed Yahweh. He trusted Yahweh. He held fast to the promise of God. And so God counted it to him as righteousness.
Question. He counted it to him. Is that here in the Hebrew that it's God to count it to Abram, or is that only because of Romans that it clarifies?
I would say that the antecedents, I'd have to look at the Hebrew again, the antecedents don't prove it, but I think the context makes it clear enough. Even here, I don't think we would have to go to Romans. Do I have it here? What verse is this? 6? Let's see. I'd have to look it up. But it's possible that the construction here would be so he counted it to him as righteousness, like a therefore kind of a thing. So I'd have to look at the Hebrew to see what kind of conjunction that is. Because that would make it more clear that it's in response to Abraham's belief that it's counted to him as righteousness. I don't know offhand.
My translation says, accounted.
Yeah, not too much of a difference there.
No.
No. So, just awesome reaffirmation of the promise. Now, let me just summarize the rest of the chapter for sake of time. As he comes in verse 7, you know, I'm going to give you this land. Once again, just the land and the seed and the blessing. Those are the three components of the Abrahamic promise. And they keep getting repeated and reaffirmed throughout this section. God's going to give Abram the land. He's going to give him descendants and ultimately a seed to make him into a great nation. And he's going to bless him and bless the world through him. That's the three aspects of the Abrahamic covenant. They keep getting reaffirmed as Abram continues to walk in faith. And as you know, as we're talking about progressive revelation, it is neat to see that after every step of faith that Abraham makes, God keeps reaffirming. And it does kind of show that it's like we're saying along, it's somewhat of a paradox, but it is a two-part process. The promise can only be fulfilled as Abraham is obedient, right? And that's why we see as Abraham continues to trust and be obedient, the promise keeps getting reaffirmed and reassured. And ultimately, it becomes kind of, even here, it becomes like sealed in stone. Because he says, I'm going to make an everlasting covenant, and it's not going to be broken, and it's an eternal covenant. And all this kind of terminology that keeps running through as God keeps reaffirming and reassuring how certain this promise is to Abraham. And so ultimately, you know, we know that this will be fulfilled. It becomes more and more clear. But just to summarize, basically what happens in the rest of the chapter is God says, okay, take, what does he say, a pigeon and a turtle dove and a ram, cut them all in half, cut them in pieces, put them, you know, on the two sides, and then God says, basically a deep sleep falls on Abram. And God, well, it says a flaming torch passed between the pieces. And Abraham's asleep, and he doesn't walk through the pieces. And you're like, okay, that's really weird. What are all these pieces, animals, dead animals, flaming torch, smoke, sleeping Abraham? What does all that mean? All right, I'll just summarize it briefly. This is a covenant ceremony. Basically, what they would do is, if you're going to enter into a covenant, and a covenant is basically it's like a marriage, you know, there's obligations on both sides. If you do this, I'll do this,
contract.
And was a contract good. That's a good word for it. And so normally in this time period, when you're going to do a contract, this is what you do. You cut the pieces, put them onto, and the two people would walk through it together and kind of be symbolic. It's like, if you break your side of the deal, may you be like these dead animals around us.
They still do that in Africa a lot.
Oh, really?
Like, they're doing it now with everything that happened with Rwanda and even in Uganda. In Rwanda with the genocide, and then in Uganda with just like all the child soldiers that were abducted. And so the people are, in order to reconcile, they were former soldiers, but they were abducted as kids. And then the community is like, okay, we want to have you come back in our society, but like, you know, Mike Lowe killed my father, and I recognize that he was abducted into that army, and it's not his fault, but at the same time, so there's this whole reconciliation where they cut the throat and blood, and then they walk through and pass through. And,
really?
Sorry, no.
No, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. But what's different about this?
It's with God.
Yeah, that's one. What else?
Abraham.
Yeah, Abraham's asleep. What does that signify? What's that?
It's a covenant that God has made.
Right, it's a covenant that God alone is obligating himself to keep. In other words, this is a unilateral covenant. Most covenants are bilateral. If you do this, I'll do this. This is God saying, let me die and me alone if I don't fulfill my part of the covenant. Right? So it's an awesome statement that, you know, even as you go, where does it say? Well, just verse 18. On that day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I give this land from the river Egypt. Now here it defines it even more carefully and expands it even greater. And I think this is probably, as far as I know, the greatest extent of the promise to Abram. From the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates. I mean, that's big. That's like into Iraq, right? I mean, everyone knows where the Euphrates is at. This is not just little Israel that we're talking about now. Israel has never possessed this much land, ever, in their history. Even in Solomon's day, it didn't extend to this big. So that's why I would say, God just said, let me die if I don't do this. And he hasn't done it yet, which can only lead us to one conclusion. Which is what? He's going to do it. Right? When Christ comes again as king, he's going to reign over the land from the great river Egypt to the river Euphrates. Right? God is going to keep his promise. He made it very, very clear that he's going to do it.
Real quick question. In verse 18, in the ESV, there's a note, to your offspring I give. And the note is have given. Would you agree that that's... It seems to emphasize what you're saying. It's unilateral. It's already done. It's not like, if you're faithful, I'm going to, but like I have done this already.
Right. Yeah, I think so. Now, I want to come back to this little statement. This is kind of interesting in verses 13 through 16. You know for certain, God says to Abraham, that your offspring will be sojourners in the land that is not theirs, and they'll be servants there. They will be afflicted 400 years, but I'll bring judgment on the nation they serve, and after they will come out in great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried in good old age. They'll come back here in the fourth generation. Now, this is kind of an interesting little section in here. And I think that the point of this is that you got to wait, right? The 400 years emphasize the fact that it's not going to all happen instantaneously. You know, you're going to even die without seeing the fulfillment of the promise, but you still got to trust me. You know, God says this is what's going to happen. It's going to be 400 years, but yet, you know, you're not going to see it. But ultimately, God's choice of Abraham and God's election of the nation are those, and pulling them out of Egypt, are those two key events in the formation of and the foundation of the nation of Israel. And so kind of God gives them a picture of it ahead of time and tells them ahead of time. And I think it's just the emphasis, you need to wait for it because it's not going to even happen in your lifetime. All right, so once again, just God reaffirms and reassures Abram that he's going to keep this awesome, awesome promise. Okay.
This might be a silly question, but what would a smoking oven be in those days?
You know what? I do not know. I mean, certainly they had all kinds of ovens.
Yeah.
You know, but I do not know what this oven looked like. A flying oven. That's, yeah, it's kind of, would have been an interesting sight. But obviously just the fire representing the holiness and the awesome nature of God.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a picture of God ultimately. All right, now just quickly, we got to keep moving. Chapter 16, we all know, is once again another failure of faith of Abram. In chapter 16, let's read the first few verses here. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. Has some important background information for us. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Yahweh has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant, and it may be that I may obtain children by her." And Abram... did I say that right? Yeah, so Sarai said that to Abram. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. Ring a bell? Yeah, just like Adam and Eve, right? Adam listened to the voice of his wife. And so, as we see here in verse 3, so after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And notice that little statement in there. It'd be easy to pass over it quickly. 10 years. I think it points to the fact that basically, you know, what's happening, God? We've been in the land of Canaan 10 years. Aren't you going to give me a son? You promised. And in this moment of weakness, right, he didn't trust God. And, you know, he's been there 10 years, and his wife comes in and says, "Hey, why don't you do it this other way?" Right? It's kind of out of a desire to fulfill the promise, but not to do it God's way. And that's the important aspect in here. Not only do you have to trust in God for the promise, but trust that to do it God's way. That's what so much of faith is, right? You know, this is kind of off on a tangent, but that's what's so wrong with so many methodologies in the church today, right? People want to see people saved, and so they'll compromise on methodology and maybe, you know, whatever kind of movement you want to go out there where they try to, like, attract people by compromising God's word, whether it be kind of like a message that leaves out sin, you know, to try to make the gospel more palatable to people. It's out of a good desire, I think, that people do that. You know, so many pastors and churches, they want to see people saved. It's the right goal, but they compromise on the methodology. Right? They don't have faith that the best way to see people saved is to preach the word as God has said it. Right? And they think that they know a better way than God. And that's ultimately what Abram did, right? And Sarai. You know, they knew what God wanted. They knew what the goal was, to have a child and all this, but they didn't ultimately trust God's way of doing it. They compromised and they thought, "Hey, I got a way to help God along." You know, and that's often what we do in our methodologies when we don't trust God, and once again, it just comes back to simple faith and obedience. Are we going to do it God's way and trust that he's going to bring about the results, or are we going to try to figure it out for ourselves and say, "No, I know better than God what would be best." And so you know the story. Abram goes into Hagar, she gives a son, he has Ishmael, and what does it cause? All kinds of problems, right? And so now Hagar and Sarai, you know, getting this big, huge fight. And so Abram has to kick Hagar out. And it's like breaks his heart because he loves his son Ishmael. And just, like, all these problems because he didn't trust God. And ultimately, the whole battle between all the Arabs and Israel is because of this. Right? This lapse of faith. And you see certainly the Israelites that received the book of Genesis in Moses' day would have been like, "Oh, Abraham, why did you do that? Like, all these Arabs hate us and are trying to, like, kill us and stuff," you know? And it's like they would have understood how this lapse of faith resulted in, you know, trouble, I guess you could say, and then just consequences. And so ultimately, let me just finish out the chapter by saying that, you know, Abram kicks Hagar, his servant, out into the desert, but God even cares for her. Because ultimately it's not Hagar's fault, and God gives her beautiful promises to make Ishmael into a great nation, and God is watching out for Hagar, even though Abram's sin resulted in her getting kicked out. And so once again, it's God's care. All right, we better keep going and finish off these last few chapters. Okay, so we get... Yes, sir.
So, if he took Hagar as his wife, would that have been a sin?
I believe so, yes.
Because you couldn't have multiple wives then?
Yes, and it's not explicit, you know, prior to this. Although, you know, even with Lamech all the way back in what chapter was that? 4? You know, he's put in a bad light for having kind of for being the first polygamist. And obviously all the patriarchs pretty much did it. I guess I'd put it like this. You know, there was less revelation to them. And so, you know, certainly it's more clear to us how wrong that is than it was clear to them. But I would say, you know, the ideal was still one man and one wife. Right? It was set back all the way in Genesis. You know, cleave, become one flesh. It's never like explicitly stated that it's sinful, you know, up until that point, but I think it was clear enough that they should have known better.
Also, I don't think Sarah is necessarily included in the plan explicitly.
That's true, but I think it's kind of implicit that We have to wrestle with that. I would say, A, just the whole kind of polygamy thing kind of makes it implicitly wrong. B, I think the rest of the story shows that it's out of a lack of faith, you know, that they did this. And so, I mean, I agree with you. It's tough to, like, say, well, how we can't clearly see God said, you know, it's through Sarai at this point in time that, you know, this is going to happen. But, you know, it's Abram and Sarai, right? I mean, God had made the promise, like, I'm going to give you a child. And, I mean, obviously, you know, in just a little bit here, the promise is going to be to Sarai that, you know, it's going to come. But I think it's somewhat implicit throughout here that it was out of a lack of faith that they did that. So, yeah. And even just the consequences, right, make it pretty clear.
Can you also say that she's Egyptian or no?
I don't think that's so much it.
Is that not an issue until later, or? Like,
yeah, probably not till later. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just more of the fact that, you know, ultimately marriage from the beginning was one man and one woman, and God had given the promise to Abram, and ultimately it was a lack of faith on Sarah's part that, you know, God could do anything. He gave this promise. You don't have to find a way. You know, God can do it. And it's just out of that lack of faith that they acted. And ultimately, that's going to be, we'll get to it in a little bit, but the key verse of, where is it? I'll find it here in a second, but where God says, is anything too difficult for Yahweh? I think it's in chapter 18. The whole point being, nothing's too difficult for Yahweh. He could bring about his plan. He will do what he has promised.
And to keep on the implicit of it, this is the only time that Hagar is really mentioned in this
part. Yeah, I think so.
Well, later on, Ishmael and Hagar are allowed to come back, because then they kick him out permanently the second time. Because it says in chapter 21 that Ishmael was scoffing at...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then, right. So it's kind of like, I think Abraham had some pity and allowed them to come back into the family, and then Sarah got mad again and said, this servant and her son have to go.
Right.
Because this is the real child of promise, and he's going to go now.
Yeah, you're right. All right, so let's keep walking here. Chapter 17. How do we summarize this? basically, this is another reaffirmation of the covenant. And you read through this section, it's all about the covenant. It's all about circumcision, the sign of the covenant. And just, once again, this two-way relationship that, yes, God has made these unilateral promises that I will do this, I am going to give you the land, I'm going to give you offspring and blessing. But then also there's the sign of the covenant that, you know, Abram and his descendants are going to walk faithful and obedient to God in fulfilling what God calls them to be. And so you just see more and more promises. Verse 1, Abram was 99 years old, and Yahweh appeared to him and said, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. Abram fell on his face, and God said, Behold, my covenant is with you. You shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of a multitude of nations. And just on and on, kings will come for you, and my covenant will be, verse 7, an everlasting covenant. And I'll give your offspring the land, and an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And just God more clearly just reaffirms this promise and just affirms it and secures it that it's going to be everlasting. In other words, it cannot fail. It cannot, you know, this covenant cannot be broken because it's an everlasting, eternal covenant. And you shall, verse 9, keep my covenant, right? So it's to keep the sign of circumcision. Verse 13, so my covenant will be in your flesh, an everlasting covenant. And everyone who doesn't keep the covenant will be cut off. He has broken my covenant. So you see kind of the twofold nature of it. But God just, once again, that tension of, yes, this is an everlasting covenant that God will keep. God has promised. But also the fact that you need to keep my covenant. You need to be a part of my people. And just that continual emphasis once again.
Why didn't they do it in the wilderness?
Yeah, just disobedience, I guess. I don't know. That's a good question. All right, same thing with Sarai. You know, verse 15 and following changes her name to Sarah. Bless her. Give Abraham a son through her. She will become nations. And God and Abraham fell on his face, and they're just amazed that God would give them such an awesome promise. And God continues throughout this chapter to give promise to Ishmael as well. And basically it ends with Abraham circumcising his whole household. So just once again, the emphasis on chapter 17 is just the reaffirmation of the covenant. It's an eternal covenant. God is going to keep it. God, once again, this is God's plan is through Abraham. And he just reaffirms it, that you could trust that this will come to pass. And I guess I just say it's a covenant reaffirmation as just a quick summary of this chapter. All right, we'll keep moving here. Verse chapter 18, Yahweh appeared to him, to Abram, that is, by the oaks of Mamre, and he sat at the door. Basically, Yahweh and two angels show up. You know, this we call this probably a theophany or a Christophany, where probably the pre-incarnate Christ. There's this man and two angels who show up at Abraham's door, and one of those men is Yahweh himself, as the text becomes clear. It says, and the two of the men left, and Abraham was left talking with Yahweh. And so, you know, this is probably the pre-incarnate Christ. It's God in human form. Pretty awesome statement. And so, God, you know, Abram is here, and it's, you know, basically they have a meal. Abraham, the first 8 verses, he prepares a meal, and what it really points to is, especially in this probably, you know, you might know better, but this is probably true in Africa too, the eating of a meal was so much a sign of fellowship, and often just the sign of the covenant. And so this eating of this meal together between God and Abraham really signifies that they have a relationship, that they're covenant partners, that they're in fellowship with one another. That's really what a covenant is. It's like a marriage. It's not just a contract. That word is too stale. It's too just kind of dry. A covenant is a relationship. And yes, it has obligations, like a contract would, much more personal than that. And I think the first eight verses really show that as God eats a meal with Abraham, God himself. And so they have this, if you will, covenant meal together. And so, you know, God talks to Abraham and says, you know, you're going to have a son. And of course, Sarah laughs because she doesn't think it can happen. And where is it? You know, God says no. Oh, there's the great verse 14. In verse 14. Is anything too hard for Yahweh? And that's the theme verse of this whole section. Nothing is too difficult. Nothing is too... It's hard is kind of a weak translation. It's really like, is anything too wonderful? Is anything too magnificent? Is anything too splendid for God? And of course, it's a rhetorical question to which the answer is no. Nothing is too miraculous. Nothing is too spectacular for him to do. And so therefore, just the need to trust in him. And so I love what happens here. So the men set out from there to go to Sodom. In other words, the two of the three men go to Sodom. Because, you know, we'll see why in a second. But look at verse 17. Yahweh said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of Yahweh by doing righteousness and justice, so that Yahweh may bring to Abraham what he has promised him." This is fascinating. Okay, so you get the picture. Here's these three men. They just had this covenant meal together. Two of the men are going to Sodom. But Yahweh himself stays with Abraham. And Yahweh is like, you're kind of hearing God's thoughts here. He's like, should I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? What's he about to do? About to wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. But he says, no. He's like, I shouldn't hide my plan from Abraham. What's so cool about this is God is saying, like, look, this is the man through whom my plan is. This is the man of my plan. And so, you know, my plan is to bless the world through him. And so, you know, I'm not going to hide my plan from him. I'm going to show him my plan. And once again, it kind of shows how Abraham is at the center of God's plan, and God includes him even on the plan so that he could see and even notice the theme of righteousness and justice. I think it shows that, you know, God wants Abraham to see there his righteousness and his justice so that Abraham gets a fuller picture of it as being the man of God's plan. He could teach that to his children, as it says here. And so it's an awesome little verse how, you know, because the whole world is going to be blessed through Abraham and God has chosen him for that purpose, he includes him in his plan so he can understand what God is doing in the world. Does that make sense? It's pretty awesome, you know, that God chose this man and chose to include him in his plan. And so there's that intimate relationship, and he even allows Abraham to know what's in God's own mind concerning his plan for the world and to understand his righteousness and his justice. And so basically God says, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah are wicked. And so he's going to go down and take a look and see if they deserve what they deserve. And of course they do. Now, and so the men, verse 22, turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before Yahweh. In other words, one of these three men is there, and that's the Lord himself. It's Yahweh. And you know what happens. Abraham intercedes for the city, right? And he says, you know, how does he start off? He starts off with, what, 50 people? Is that right? And Abraham says, you know, God includes him in the plan, and then Abraham's like, well, you know, starts to interact with this plan. He's like, what if there's 50 righteous people in all of Sodom? You know, would you wipe it out for that? You know, you're a righteous God. You wouldn't wipe out these 50 people. Of course, you know, they go back and forth, and God's like, no, I wouldn't. And so Abraham, like, is arguing. He's reasoning with God, trying to intercede for the city. And this is what's so beautiful about this, is you see once again that God works through Abraham. We're going to see this, that ultimately God spares Lot because of Abraham. You want to be saved? The message is salvation comes through association with Abraham. We'll get to it in just a little bit, but you even see that here in this intercession. Abraham is the one who has a relationship with God. Abraham is the priest, if you will, that stands between the people and God. And as this priest, he cares for even, you know, the people of Sodom, and is interceding for them. And that's so much what the role of the nation of Israel was to have, to be that kingdom of priests, to be that righteous group of people who had a relationship with God that mediated his salvation to the world. And you see that even in Abraham.
Also but, because Lot's there.
Yeah, and obviously, because Lot's there. And so, basically, as you get to the end, they keep, you know, just the boldness that Abraham says, and finally he gets down to 10 people. And Abraham, like, stops at 10 because he's like, Lot, his wife, three daughters, three sons, maybe a couple servants. All right, we'll call it good. You know, there's probably at least 10 righteous people in the city. You know, he was probably counting, you know, trying to get down to, like, how many he knew were there so that Lot would be spared. And so he gets down to 10, and finally he stops. And so finally we get to chapter 19, and you know what happens. The two men go in, and they're, you know, these angels are like, they meet up with Lot. And oh, notice what it says. Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Okay, Lot's gone from like dwelling, putting his tents near Sodom, to living in Sodom, to sitting in the gate of Sodom. And the gate was the place where all, I wish I had a picture, one of my pictures of the city gate, but that's where like the marketplace was. That's where all the, what's the right word? Like the judges would sit, like for court matters. Like, you know, that was like the kind of the official place of the city was the city gate. And so like him sitting in the city gate means he's like kind of in with the leaders of Sodom and everything. And so Lot's sitting in the gate, and these two angels show up, and Lot immediately goes, he's like, hey, come with me to my house. They're like, no, we're just going to sleep out in the open. And he's like, no, don't do that. Come with me. Because, I mean, he knows how wicked the city is. And you know what happens, that the whole entire city is, obviously this is just absolutely gross and just detestable. And so, like, he takes them into his house, but verse 4, the whole men of the city, I just want to read this verse, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. I mean, obviously, just the absolute wickedness of Sodom. It's everybody. Old, young, I mean, everybody in the whole city comes to Lot's house to get those two, well, we know, angels. You know, but it's just emphasizing how completely wicked the entire, and they surround it. You know, and the reason they surround it is so that nobody can escape. You know, it's like, we got you now kind of thing. And you know, obviously, just the wickedness of their hearts. And so they call out, and it's like, bring the men out that came. And you know, Lot's just compromised. He's like, take my daughters instead. I mean, just have my daughters, they're virgins, you take them, do whatever. Just the wickedness of this city. And they're like, who are you, Lot? You're like a newcomer. Why are you judging us, trying to tell us that what we do is wrong, you know? Just, we're going to kill you just like them. And then obviously the angels like smite all the men with blindness. And notice they grab Lot and they pull him in the door, you know, and smite the people. And where am I going to pick up here? Verse 10, they bring him in, they struck the men with blindness. And the men said to Lot, verse 12, have you anyone else here? And bring them out of this place, we're about to destroy it. You know, we're going to destroy the city. So Lot went out to his sons-in-law. He's like, quick, get up. But his sons-in-law, like, they didn't believe. And so they died with the city. And so as morning dawned, the angel urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment in the city. But he lingered. It's amazing how hard it is to get Lot out of the city. You know, it's amazing. He's so, like, tied there. And so the men grabbed him and drug him out of the city. These two angels, you know, just out of compassion for Lot. And they grab him, and so Lot and his wife and his three daughters are running away from Sodom. And he says, and they say, run, don't turn back, just run. And you will know, of course, that Lot's wife, just her heart still being in the wicked city of Sodom, turned back and looked back just out of a desire to be there even, you know, and turned into a pillar of salt instantly. died on the spot. And so Lot and is left with his three daughters escaping. And go to verse 23. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar, and then Yahweh rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from Yahweh out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. I mean, just everything. Just wiped it out. Burned it up. But Lot's wife behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. And notice this. This is the key verse here. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before Yahweh. And he looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked up and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. Notice this. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived. You notice that? Why did God save Lot? It's Abraham. Right? And the message is very clear. Abraham is the way to have a relationship with God. Abraham is the man that God has chosen, right? And so salvation comes through the nation of Israel. That's clear in the Old Testament. And obviously, as we get to the New Testament, we have exclusivism as well. Not in the same kind of a way, but salvation is only found in the descendant of Abraham, in the Lord Jesus Christ. It's only through him. It's only through association with him and his plan. So once again, we see that Abraham is the center of God's plan. God has this plan. He works through one man. And through that man, he gave these awesome promises to bless the world. And you see that what he calls for Abraham is just simple faith and obedience. We see the triumphs of Abraham's faith when he goes in victory and conquers all these kings. We also see when he fails and he lies about his wife. Or when he goes in with Hagar and he doesn't trust God. And you see the repercussions and even how God's plan in one sense comes on the brink of destruction when Abraham seeks to take God's plan into his own hands. But we see that ultimately God will fulfill his plan, and his plan he will bring to pass because of all the promises that he brought about through Abraham. And so the chapter ends with this story of I said three daughters, didn't I? He's got two daughters, sorry. I don't know where I said that from. But anyway, it ends up with Lot getting Lot's two daughters getting him drunk and having kids through him because they didn't have... And the whole thing just ends in this wicked debacle. And you find the story ends with like Lot drunk and having kids with his two daughters. And the point is, you just kind of watch Lot, watch the Lot, life of Lot, and you see the results of his unwise choice at the beginning. You see his lack of faith and not... It's interesting because, even the New Testament would teach us that that Lot was a righteous man. But you see, just the results of his compromises. He did leave the city. He didn't turn back like his wife and get killed in the process. He did have some measure of faith, but it took the angels to drag him out of it. You can't necessarily, in one sense, blame him too much, I guess, in the sense that his daughters got him drunk. But, it's his own daughters. And just you see the effects of his living in the city of Sodom and just the wickedness that surrounded them on his whole family. And what a sad, sad way that it ends that, here's Lot, this kind of pathetic man. And just as it started off when he was so blessed because of Abraham. And so, once again, just kind of that contrast and just the reminder that, as soon as Lot left Abraham and went his own way and did his own thing and compromised and didn't trust God, just look at the terrible results of it all. So I know we covered a lot of ground there. But it's, at least for me, it's fun just to look at these stories, right? Because there's lessons here. And the basic lessons are so applicable to us, just to trust in God's plan, to realize we shouldn't take things into our own hands, and know that God, nothing's too difficult for God. He's going to bring about his plan. and he blesses those who trust in him. So many of these just great lessons that we need every day. You know, because like you were saying, we're constantly thrown into circumstances where we're tempted to compromise. We're tempted to do things our way instead of God's way. Or we're tempted to think that we need to help God along. Or we despair because we don't think God is going to bring about his promise. It doesn't look like he's doing anything. But, you know, just like Abraham had to wait and didn't see the fulfillment of everything, even 10 years before he had a son. And then he only had one son. You know, it just took forever in one sense for this thing to bring about, but you just continue to see God bring about his plan and his purpose, and just the need to believe and trust. And you also see the blessings, right? As Abraham trusted and walked with God and obeyed him, and just that great statement that Abraham believed God, and you see just God blessing him and using him and bringing about. And the lesson for us that if we obey God and trust in God, God is going to use us as well to fulfill his plan. And so it's a great, great, great lessons for us. And it also just gives us such a great perspective on God's plan for the world. How that all comes about ultimately through the Lord. And just his plan ultimately to save. And we see that so clearly as we walk through Genesis. Any other comments or questions?
Would you say that God chose to bless Lot because of Abraham's prayer? And for the sake of Abraham, even Lot's descendants were blessed. These kids that were born out of incest, these sons became the fathers of two nations, too.
Yeah, but even, yeah, absolutely.
Even that is but because of Abraham.
Yeah, certainly it's that amazing statement that God remembered Abraham and saved Lot.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing verse. It's so impactful. But then again, you see the flip side of it, that Moab and what are the two?
Ammon.
Yeah. Those are the two cities that opposed Israel. You know, they were Israel's enemies. And you see
so
the result
sort
of
blessed, but not blessed.
Yeah, you see the results of the sin. You know, I guess you could put it this way. You see both on the one hand how simple acts of obedience results in God's plan to save the world. You know, it's an amazing thought that through this one man, through his simple obedience, God's going to save the world. Right? But on the flip side, through this man's disobedience and lack of wisdom, Israel's enemies are brought about that oppose them. And so I think it helps, it gives us a perspective to see that God does big things through us. Right? When we obey, God brings about his plan to save people. We disobey, you know, there's consequences that are even big also. And so it's just a reminder, we tend to minimize what we do, you
yeah.
know, and we don't see it from God's perspective.
That's a great point.
So hopefully it'll be encouragement for all of us that when as we obey, God works out his plan through us as well, right, to save the world. God is using us to bring about his plan to save the world. And so that's an awesome thought that we could be a part of that. And really helps us to get perspective of why we're here and what we're supposed to be about. You know, if this is God's plan for the world, certainly that should inform how we live. And so for me, reading through Genesis, although an unlikely place in one sense when I first started off, has been the biggest impetus for the gospel and mission and reaching out to the lost than in one sense even any New Testament book. Because it's all about God's plan for the world. You know, this is the beginning. You know, you can't get more foundational than this. And so it helps us to put everything in perspective as why we are a church and what we're here for. So, I mean, even just applications, right? As we're reaching out to friends and neighbors and, you know, once again, you know, our temptations to be ashamed of the gospel because we are not trusting in God, or our temptations maybe to use worldly methodologies to rather than just trusting in God, you know, but just the application to us is this is God's plan. He wants us to just obey him, and he's told us what he wants is for us to proclaim his word and the gospel, and he's going to work through us and bless us and save the world as we do that. So a lot for us to learn. All right, so we'll pick up from there, and we're gonna move pretty quick. I don't know how many chapters we'll get through, but we'll probably get at least through 22, maybe a little bit further, as we continue to walk through Genesis and just see the great lessons of faith as we walk along. All right. I'm going to take us to talk about praises and prayer requests.